So please join me in welcoming Stu to our podium. Stu, floor.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for coming out, and Dwight for allowing me to share my story. I hope it's encouraging to some of you. I went from agnostic to apologist, so I'm no longer a preaching agnostic, I'm a preaching apologist.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we're going to talk about from agnostic to apologetics today. Have you ever been fearful in your life? I have. When I was a young, hardcore, driving, agnostic businessman, fear came upon me in three different waves over a six-month period, over a five-year period, actually. And it ended in an agonizing five-minute wrestle with God. And I want to tell you about that today. Also, what the lessons learned from that whole process were. The story begins on a gorgeous April morning. Gorgeous April morning. I'm out there jogging like I did every day, pretty much before my business day, meditating. I didn't know God in those days. Meditation was really the core of my life. What I meditated on was trying to find purpose in life. I am a reader, a studier, and so forth. I was into a lot of different stuff. Ayn Rand, for example, and her philosophy of objectivism. Maxwell Maltz with psychological techniques of psycho-cybernetics. And because I was analytical, though, I thought, I can figure out the meaning to life. And then I'll have it all wired, right? Convinced myself that once I discovered my purpose in life, that I could live the dream and just reflect on that goal for the rest of it. How am I going to do this? Well, I reflected on my daughter's birth. It was just recent, and like all of us who have seen the miracle of a newborn child, 9 months to do this amazing thing, geez, certainly I could figure out what the meaning of life was in 9 months. Oh, how naive and deceived I was. But every day I would meditate during my jog, and mile after mile, minute after minute, and you know what? It actually worked. All that meditation actually worked. I came up with the answer to life after 9 months. And here it is. Fame and fortune. That's the best I could come up with. And I was serious about it. And I said, is that all there is to this? But I had discovered it, so I'm going to commit myself to fame and fortune. And I went to work with that starting out each day, and sure enough, it did work. My company started growing. I was on my way. I had discovered it. I had left an executive position with a major oil company shortly before that to start my own software company. And I was successful by the world standards. My picture appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Computer World. I lived in this lovely home in Southern California near the beach. I had a beautiful wife, two great kids. I thought I had it all figured out. But guess what happened? This euphoria that I originally had just started wearing off. I mean, the world heralds fame and fortune. You got to keep pumping yourself up and keep on doing it and so forth. But why wasn't it feeling any better? Why wasn't this working? Why did it stay? I know it's because I needed a second meditation baby. I didn't have it complete yet. I'm going to complete this. So another 9 months, more miles, more deep thinking, more meditation. This time the answer comes back. Status and leadership. Aha. Now I got this secret on its way. Fame, fortune, status, leadership, and guess what? It worked. More power, more money, more recognition, higher status. But again, the answer though, what was happening? I know, I rationalize good things really only happen in threes. Let's try this one more time, more miles, more meditation, more trying to find out the purpose of life. And I'm discovering it, after 9 more months, the final couplet magically appears. Power and security. Now my mantra must be completed. Now, power to rule, security to protect it all, same outcome.
Yep.
Growing worldly success, but quickly followed by this diminished euphoria, empty now, even depressing. I'm a jazz fan, particularly the old standards. Do any of you remember Peggy Lee?
Okay.
It goes back a little bit. There was a song she had during that time that just haunted me at the same time I was doing all this. If this recalls, you call this. April morning, I'm jogging. It's beautiful. The skies are filled with these beautiful puffy clouds, and I'm into my completed mantra here. Still, one is kind of reeling from why this is all this euphoria is not keeping up. And I just gazed up into the blue sky, and the thought of a creator came to me. Now, I didn't really believe in a personal God, and certainly not in Jesus. I was a physics major in college. I knew the scientists had the whole universe figured out. It came together by natural law. I mean, if God existed, he must be some sort of equation. But there had to be some beginner anyway. And someday science would discover how all this worked. But the awesome beauty of the sky that morning was so compelling, and I was desperate, I thought to myself, well, just in case this God equation exists, I'll add it to my meditation list. So now I have all bases covered. I added G-O-D right to the bottom of my list. Each rhythmic stride from then on would be fame, fortune, status, leadership, power, security, and God. I was soon to discover that you don't haphazardly add God to the bottom of any list. Like the Philistines who put the Ark of the Covenant in their temple alongside the idol Dagon, soon experienced disaster. I was about to experience a disaster when I put my idols next to G-O-D. Within a week, my life started falling apart. My secretary moved me the $10,000 check. The next day, I needed to make payroll. My Jaguar stolen from a downtown Los Angeles hotel. My newest and most promising customer canceled the largest contract we had to date, demanding a deposit back. Now I'm suddenly thrust into a higher level of fear. First level of fear was there was no purpose to life. Second level is not only wasn't my formula working, but my real world was falling apart. Around Easter that year, I was watching television. It was Jesus of Nazareth was on. And there was something indeed transcendent about this man. He apparently wasn't just another religious leader. It seems that he could heal people and perform miracles, and I needed both. Unexpectedly, soon thereafter, my wife and I are having dinner with the treasurer of the major Silicon Valley Corporation. John was a Christian. I couldn't quite put those two qualities together, right? Didn't know a group like this even existed at that point in time. I thought most Christians were rather naive, unsophisticated in business, people who needed a psychological crutch. That was my experience. He was none of them. He was very successful, but we could talk about philosophy and purpose of life just as easily as we talked about business. That was something I had not previously encountered with Christians before. So I felt free to tell him my story. And he gives me a book to read by Francis Schaeffer, The God Who Is There. Any nods in the room on that one? For those of you who are not familiar with Francis Schaeffer, he is a Christian apologist. Schaeffer gave reasons why the natural world could not be the result of itself, why there was real evidence that God created the world and everyone in it. And he created it for us and created it for a purpose. Wow, what a new thought that is. There was a God who gives us creatures meaning and purpose. Schaeffer made a compelling case. So I tested his thoughts against what I knew about science. I was pretty studied in this. Two of the most fundamental laws of the universe are called the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Fancy names for something we all recognize. First law, matter and energy cannot be created nor destroyed. Yet here is the world. Where did all this stuff come from? Come out of nothing? Second law, the whole universe is winding down to a heat death. Yet if it had an ending, it must have had a beginning. What could possibly have started this whole thing off? What power could there be? Then sustain it after a while. My presupposition was that it all started by an accidental Big Bang. But what was the Big Bang? And where did that come from? How did it get its energy? I never really questioned this before. It was basically unexamined territory in school. But Schaeffer showed that it was my training that was preventing me from considering a whole different set of assumptions. They resided in an upper story, a set of assumptions that started with the Creator and not with an accident. On December 28th of that year, I was driving to the office while pondering these things. In a flash of insight, I was given a spectacular visual that helped me put this whole picture together. I was approaching downtown Los Angeles, and there was this hideous, thick smog layer smothering the city, but thousands of cars going in, driving through this, probably not noticing, just 2,000 feet above, were these magnificent San Gabriel snow-colored mountains, crystal clear, the sun reflecting on the mountains. And I thought to myself, wow, this is what a great picture is of what I'm experiencing. I'm in this smog, and everybody else not looking up, and yet there's this city of man sitting there, suffocating in this smog, and yet right above it is this crystal clear city of God, kingdom of God, hovering over top, just ruling over the puny things that man had built. But this is scary. To go any further with this thought would require a leap of faith. I would have to challenge the worldview I had carried for years. That's when my third level of fear began. In some ways, faith is a simple thing, and we're all here after years of experiencing that. Just believe, trust. At that time, however, it was the most difficult thing to believe. I thought I would have to put my brain on hold. Put it on the shelf. I would need to believe that a Creator God actually existed, really existed, and that Jesus was the way to find him. I couldn't, in all honesty, believe that. But that's where Schaeffer and apologetics came to the rescue again. I didn't need to make a blind leap of faith. All I had to do was take a sincere step of rational faith. Apologetics made that possible. I came face to face with assumptions that I had carried around with me for years, and I saw that the assumptions of the Christian faith were just as reasonable, just as legitimate, as any materialistic set of assumptions were. The big sense that an eternal and all-powerful God outside the universe could create things inside the universe, that miracles could be real. 95% of the world believes that. Things just don't create themselves. And it made more sense if things would have a beginning. They couldn't be eternal since everything in the universe was dying. I could now accept with intellectual honesty the possibility of what the Bible said about creation. I'm on my way. Now the cup is perfect. I had to accept that I was a sinner
and Jesus was my Savior.
That's a tough one. The world taught, and I believe, that man was basically good. In fact, evolving, getting better and better. The Bible says that man's heart was evil, and that the world was fallen and getting worse. Well, after 5 years of unsuccessful meditation, resulting in disappointing experience after experience, I could accept this now. I had came to the conclusion, as I put it, the world is a lie. But the biblical claim that the Creator God would save you through Jesus was still just an unfounded and scary religious proposition. Again, apologetics for the rescue. Christianity was based on evidence. Historically, practically to the point of historical proof. Jesus claimed to be God and proved it by resurrecting himself from the dead. No other religion or philosophy of life could make a historically justifiable claim like that. So I was saved with either Christianity or Peggy B. I would have to believe in either Jesus or just keep on dancing, bring out the booze, and have a ball. This decision gripped me intensely. What if I was being misled? This was just crazy. I mean, voices in my head surrounded me. I was going to be another one of those crazy holy rollers, giving a testimony years later. On the other hand, the biblical claim was the only one that made sense out of life. Out of my life, anyway. I couldn't ignore it. The Bible says all you need is the faith of a mustard seed, but that morning in that car driving to Los Angeles, I wasn't sure I could even muster that much. In one gutsy, tiny step of sincere faith at 8:32 a.m. on that Los Angeles freeway, with that beautiful sunlit San Gabriel Mountain in contrast to the yuck below, and the lie below, as I now know it, I took that step of faith that was both sincere, but it was also reasoned. And it's been the most amazing journey ever since. Totally fulfilling my life with meaning and purpose. And the Creator's even given me a user manual to navigate life with. The Bible. Can you imagine? Not only a faith, but a user manual. In words, propositional truth, things I can study, find evidence for myself. Every day I start out knowing that God created me, loves me, cares for me, gives me eternal life. I have a real purpose in life, to love him back and to serve him. My purpose today, after all these years, is to be in apologetics ministry here in Colorado Springs. I just recently moved here, as Dwight said. And I served in California for decades in that capacity. And I know now in my mind, as well as my heart, that I have a personal relationship with the God who is there. He's really there. Even my experience has demonstrated that it is the most trustworthy faith relationship of any philosophy, any other religious belief. And I tried a lot of them. The power of Christian apologetics showed me that truth. Okay, technically, what is apologetics? Was important to me? Why is it important to you? Why is it important to any other believer? Let's dig into this a little bit. First, apologetics is not about making excuses. The word apologetics is literally the New Testament Greek word for defense. Defense in the sense of giving a rational justification for the truth of the Bible. As you put in the court of law. In short, giving people reasons and answers for their faith. Now, the flagship verse defining apologetics, you all know, found in 1 Peter 3:15. Always, always be ready to give an answer, a defense, an apologetic to the hope that's within you. What I'm doing right now. Apologetics is articulating reasons for why you believe what you believe. It's a handmaiden to evangelism. It's not pure evangelism. It's a handmaiden to it. It provides counter arguments to those arguments that are raised against the faith. For example, especially in today's society, Christians believe that absolute truth is revealed in the Bible. The culture wants us to believe that truth is just a personal preference. Can you make the case one way or the other? Creator says otherwise. He says that all truth, everybody's truth, is God's truth. Apologetics, then, is fundamentally giving evidence of logic that supports God's truth. Now, some Christians claim that the gospel doesn't need a defense. Just let the lion, the gospel, out of the cage. The gospel all by itself is all that's necessary. I can appreciate that view. But remember, there is also another lion roaming around, an adversary, the devil, spreading lies. Ephesians 6 tells us how to defend against the devil's lies with the belt of truth. Follow Paul's missionary journeys throughout Acts, and you will see him on the defense with apologetics, just as you see him on the offense with the gospel, just as many times. Now, with regard to culture, what does apologetics do? Well, it proposes how biblical truth will benefit society more than other worldviews. Certainly, we need that defense now as a Christian nation, as a Christian in a nation that's morally declining. That it produces a more ethical and healthier society than any other naturalistic, secular, or religious system. We no longer live in a culture defined by the Judeo-Christian ethic. We live today in a secular culture devoid of God in most every public institution. In fact, we are in the process of removing God from the entire public square. Our culture is becoming very, very similar to the one that Paul did his missionary work in. And today we have to be more like missionary Paul, but within our own culture. We must be able to persuade others why our proposed view of reality is good for society. The effective apologist is God's ambassador to explain biblical revelation to a decaying culture. Even more important, we must be able to persuade our own children, the next generation, as to the truth of the Christian faith. The single most important institution today shaping our kids' worldview is the Godless University. 3 out of 5 Christian kids abandon their faith after the age of 15. It's no understatement that the church needs to strengthen the teaching of Christian apologetics. And I, for one, am there to help. Finally, apologetics is a wonderful tool for our own Christian maturity. It strengthens our own faith as we discover that hard evidence from science and history, is actually on our side. I'm not sure we believe that. That it's actually on our side. Our case is compelling. And that greatly enhances the good news, not only for us, but for others as well. It stimulates our desire to grow in righteousness and obedience to Christ. I know it does in my life. The church in many ways is in trouble today because of our lack of theological knowledge. Many of us can't explain why we believe the Bible is true, or defend the proposition that even God exists. Ask yourself this question. How would you do it? Huge percentages in the church affirm now major tenets of ancient heresies and modern cults. Through apologetics, we learn to support biblical accounts with biblical theology, and that helps us to love God with our mind as well as our hearts. In closing, I will say with strong conviction that apologetics helped me discover the truth, and I am living proof of it. Perhaps it can help you the same way. Think on that. Here's another thought for you to ponder before that. Thank you for this. one last thought. Why did it take me 5 years to believe rather than 5 minutes? Why did it take you so long to trust sometimes?
physical, but against the spiritual forces of darkness.
John identified them.
Genesis identified them. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the boastful pride of life. In my case, it was manifested as fame and fortune, status and leadership, power and security. That is John's definition precisely. I had a 5-year spiritual battle with the devil and his lies. He tempted me with the same 3 lies that he tempted Eve. He tempted every human being ever since the garden. But the good news is that the belt of truth of the Bible and the shield of faith in Jesus Christ are able to extinguish all those arrows, the flaming missiles of the evil one. So thank God for his revelation of himself through nature and through the Bible, and for the signs and evidences he has given alongside both of them to demonstrate the truth. And thank you very much for listening.
We've got some extra time for questions, guys, so please ask Stu anything that's on your heart. Good.
I would like to know the name of the book by Francis Schaeffer that got your attention.
The God Who Is There. The God Who Is There.
And I would like to know, in the years following, is Francis Schaeffer where you'd still point someone if they were questioning and look at, would you point them to some of the Francis Schaeffer books?
Other Francis Schaeffer books? And from the brain?
Or other authors. I mean, where would you point someone now?
Right. Yeah. What happened with my apologetics after I was convinced of the truth of the gospel? I spent 5 years studying the Bible in great detail. So that's the first place to start. You need to have the basic data. Then I started discipling people and decided I need to have training in theology, but I didn't want to become a pastor. I wanted to become an apologist, so I went to a master's program in California for apologetics. There's several good ones around the country right now, so I would say that. And then from that, I went on to Christian worldview. I said, if this is true for me, it's true for the culture. And probably my biggest mentor during this time, and the books, read every one of them, by Chuck Colson. He had quite a real-world experience. I love people, obviously, that had adult conversion experiences and went on and went from 180-degree turns. So anything by Chuck Colson, starting with Born Again, and then going through even his treatment of theology and his book called The Faith is excellent. Josh McDowell was a big person in my life with evidence that demands a verdict for the truth of the Bible. Scientific apologetics is a real love of mine. The Discovery Institute, the intelligent design movement that they do now. And then on campus, I would say Rocio Christi is doing a wonderful work with students, student apologetic ministries. We're opening up these apologetic ministries on campuses throughout the country. So I'd be delighted, Jeff, to even send you a reference list of things that I went through if you'd like. Which means, too, I'll be sticking around for having one-on-one conversations or whatever afterwards. And any questions, if you'd like a copy of the talk, list of books or whatever, Gail and Jeanette are back there. They'll collect your name and business card.
I had the privilege of studying somewhat under Francis Schaeffer at Brie. It was a number of years ago, quite a few years ago. And I was wondering, God has brought you here to Colorado Springs. Is there an apologist affinity group, if you will, in the city? And I think that there are opportunities we might have to be praying this kind of a gift into various strategic locations, whether QCCS or whatever, in the city. I was wondering if you thought about.
Oh, thank you so much for asking that. Yes, since I've landed, I've been looking for those opportunities. I had the pleasure of meeting with Dr. David Noble and his wife. Dr. Noble started Summit Ministries, and when we were coming out from California here, we had dinner with he and his wife, and
he introduced me to his group, Jeff Myers and so forth, over at Summit Ministry. And that is a wonderful place. And a lot of people don't, even in town, know much about Summit because the students go to them, kind of like a brig, rather than they coming to the students. But I understand it. Isn't there somebody here from Summit? Okay, good. Yeah, I think, as I understand, you're coming off the hill now and being more active in local churches and so forth. So that's a great one. At UCCS, where is a couple of people from UCCS? Paul. Yeah, Ratio Christi, RatioChristi.org, was starting at a student apologetics ministry on the UCCS campus, and I might be involved in that. They're talking, and if somebody doesn't, let's quote, pick me up, you know, from an existing organization, I'd rather just work with existing organizations rather than start another one. But we need a network of people like you and those that are interested in this kind of thing in the area. So please leave your name with Gail or give me your card or whatever. We will get something started. We even work with the Discovery Institute, which does scientific apologetics work. They don't preach the gospel, though. That's the only thing. I cannot talk about apologetics without talking about Jesus at the end. I decided just to support that and get their chapter started. There's a couple of those things going. But you're right. We really need that. And we're no longer in this Judeo-Christian bubble. We're in a culture more like Paul's. So thank you for doing that one.
One last thing. With apologetics, sometimes it feels like we're one generation behind. In other words, we're answering sometimes questions that this coming generation isn't really wrestling with. And right now, the high school kids, college kids I'm talking to, they're not so much struggling with necessarily the existence of God or even creation. They're really being attacked in their faith when it comes to sexuality, homosexuality in particular. All right, so if that becomes the thing that my kids are wrestling with the most, Give me a quick approach as far as just what your first reaction is. Do you agree with that attack on the faith? And how do you start answering it?
Right. Great question, Jeff. Especially from a pastor, it's exciting because it sounds like you're working with the kids on the questions that are important to them. It was important to me 30-some years ago. It's not important to them now. I didn't even think about the issues that they have to struggle with. But John Stone Street, who's familiar with John, and he does the Christian Worldview for the Colson Center, has great talks on those issues that they're facing, you know, premarital sex, homosexuality, transgenderism. Those are all the hot topics today. So I think we need a combination of the older guys' wisdoms and the young people like John and everything, that and Summit deals with this all the time. I mean, you're dealing with the kids right away. I mean, they're 18 to 20-something. I mean, they're right there, and their programs are good. So I'd really say go to summit.org and see the seminars that they're putting on. They're really wonderful. Yes, sir.
I have two sons that are attending CSU. My youngest one is a sophomore. He's taking the Liberatory Philosophy class. I just sent both of them because I have a faith in the aside from that, is there any kind of recommendation you can give to the religious pastor on the hill on how to deal with the philosophy class?
Honestly, look at this Ratio Christi. Take that down. RatioChristi.org. This week, in fact, two of the fellows that are in the area were going to be here, but they're back at a major philosophy conference that's run by Southeastern Seminary back in North Carolina, right on that issue. So you see right away the philosophy. In fact, look at their 5-minute summary given by a college student of how she deals with her philosophy professor. And I think that would be
right.
RatioChristi, like ratio, Christ with an I at the end. It stands for reason for Christ, or reason of Christ. It sounds like it's a
Brother Catholic organization, but it really is an evangelical organization in Latin. I think there's somebody over here. Yes, sir.
Yeah, so you have this experience coming to the Lord, and you have family and all that. How does that decision then impact your family? Was it an immediate impact? Or, you know, you coming to faith to your wife and then the meditation baby? Or what is that process look like?
Thank you so much for asking, and we go to St. Barbara, don't we? But I can't think of it. A miracle. My wife was saved when she was 16. Her mother committed suicide, goes to church, raises her hand, went to a legalistic church, and couldn't go back because she was going to be asked how many times she witnessed that week or whatever. So by the time she meets me as an agnostic in college, she didn't know she wasn't supposed to marry me. But God knew. It's just a little background where I can answer that. But she would say things like, I have Jesus in my heart. I had no idea what she was talking about. It just sounded like a nice little fluttering, you know, heart flutter or whatever. But that was enough that when God grabs a hold of me, you know, on the freeway like that, and I come home, all right, I did it. What do I do now? We were raised in harmony. She said to me, I said, what do I do? So you go to church. I'm like, nah. She said, well, you didn't have never gone to the right kind of church. I said, well, all right, this is brand new. I'm going to try anything. Next Sunday, we go to a church and never stopped it ever since. I mean, saw things I never saw before. I mean, men carrying Bibles and families together and people laughing and people sitting up front like they really wanted to hear what the pastor had to say. We're falling asleep and there were guys with our hair cut and everything there. I mean, it was just a marvelous thing. So our family, my son was 10 years old at the time, and 6 months later he comes to the faith. My daughter, it's funny, my daughter is in a falling away stage now. She was brought up in faith. So go figure, right? I mean, here we come in from outsiders, strong, deep, and everything. She was always on a spiritual journey. But you know that it's planted in your heart. I think that's the most important thing. Yes, Ron.
Sue, I have been to many, many churches to suggest an adult apologetics or teenager through adult apologetics class that goes on and on, and have been turned down repeatedly. There's no interest. Have you experienced that? And if you have, why do you think that's happening in the church?
You're putting me on the spot in front of pastors.
Yes.
Putting my own. I think we'd all agree on some of this. Yes, it's been a struggle for 30 years to even with being in friends with a senior pastor and then believing what I'm going to do is good for them and sending people and so forth has no continuity. Apologetics seems to be one of those, and I can't speak for every church, and Jeff, you might say how it's handled in your church, but it's just one of those things that is scary to some pastors. Because it's controversial. You're giving answers that other people may disagree with. You're giving positions to worldview that other people may disagree with. And a lot of churches don't like controversy in the church. That's one thing. And also, it seems to me that a lot of pastors, and please, if you have a different view of this, aren't necessarily taught this kind of thing in seminary. On how to run a church and how to lead people to Christ. And obviously, the gospel is the most important thing. This is the defense of the gospel. But can you imagine the Broncos without their defense? I mean, I can't. I mean, it has to be alongside. But it's just not, it hasn't been a popular thing. Plus, we've had a Judeo-Christian culture. So it hasn't been as much pushback. You know, we've been more interested in expanding the gospel message, which is what we really want to do. But I think the fall of our general decline, you're going to have a lot of invitations, Ron, to do your apologetics class. That's my prediction. Yes, sir.
Seemingly, I've talked with a lot of answer I seem to get from them is just that that would be a, not a popular thing to say, but a lot of them seem to be unhappy with the new model of one person speaking and the other listening. They want to ask questions, and I wonder really, what would you say about, you know, how somebody would be particular to them, because they do.
Well, good point. And I think apologetics, the kind of thing that you're talking about, is best done in small groups where you can interact. I mean, it has to be dialogue. It's Socratic in that sense. Yeah. You ask questions, you give answers. You don't give definitive answers like you know it all, because that's just dogma. And, you know, we've been pretty interested in giving dogma. You know, this is what you believe, not why you believe it. And that's what we need to do is, well, why do you believe that? How do you, ask me a question. How do you know the, why do you believe in God? Why do you believe in the Bible? What about homosexuality? You know, open-ended questions are wonderful. But I think that also has to be promoted from the pulpit. Do this kind of thing, and there's a risk associated with that, right? So I think we need to.
Okay. Well, Stu, thanks. Thanks so much for this challenging, most interesting session. We've got a mission across the Rockies for you.